And this week, I've been working on a couple of things. I worked on the
User entering new
website,
channel.
and we had a number of things added to the website. First, the Satnog's talk, which is a 4-hour recording, got posted this week, so it's been added to the 2019 DCC video list. And then I worked on the motivation webpage, and that's been added to the Tangerine SDR website. So that's about it for me right now. And next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, everyone. I have been working on a variety of things, not all related to the project, but I have spent much of today trying to play with some data I collected. Finally decided it probably wasn't worth all that much effort and decided to collect a new set. Which is happening right now from the magnetometer. Otherwise, I don't know. Not sure what all I've been up to. I guess I started to build some more boards, but otherwise, that's it for me for now.
User joined your
Over.
channel.
Okay, next on the list, we have KD2MRC. Go ahead.
Hello, everyone. This is Hyomin Kim at KD2MCR. I have no particular update to report at this moment. I'm looking forward to hearing from Dave about the magnetometer development. That's all for now.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Mike, AA8K, shown as recording in a way. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF.
User
Go ahead,
disconnected from your
Nathaniel.
channel.
Thanks, Steve. Yes, I'm right here. Things are going fine here in Scranton. I just got off of doing a remote presentation on the Personal Space Weather Station to the
User joined your
Portage
channel.
Amateur Radio Club out in Ohio. I did that over Skype, and Tim Duffy was in the audience, so that was good. I'm looking forward to having everyone come to either come in person to Scranton in 2 weeks from now, or we will see you on the Zoom session electronically. So I'm looking forward to that. Very busy preparing for the workshop. Back to you, W2NAF.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Tom N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everyone in the group. Let's see, updated the ICD, the interface control document for the receiver, and that picks up all the changes, or hopefully all the changes, that happened to the receiver when it actually got laid out. There were a lot of connector pins that got swapped to ease routing, and there have been a few changes to the receiver. So that document should be reasonably correct now, and should be able to use that. And Scotty, later on, I've got a couple questions of you. I need to fill out the paperwork here for the assignment, so we can talk about those later. Back to the group, Dave.
Fine business. And next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dave, and thanks again for running the show here. We really appreciate it. And thanks to Mike for recording and posting. It's very helpful. So this week, mostly spent some time reviewing Bill's graphical chart, I guess what you call it, to showing the protocol between the local host and the DE. Hopefully you got that, Bill. I sent it out a couple of days ago, so it's about the progress here, and I'll turn it back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And next on the list is Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thanks very much and good evening to all. Yes, Scotty, I did get it. And in fact, I had planned to have some discussions ready. I would plan to have that reviewed and be ready to discuss it a little bit tonight. However, I worked the ARRL DX competition all through the weekend, so was exhausted and got a late start this morning. And then it took me about 3.5 hours to finally get my contest log uploaded to the ARRL. I think they're having a problem with their website where the normal uploads, it pretends like it uploads it, but it always comes back and tells you that your contest log is not properly formatted. And I've been submitting these logs for years, and I know that it is. So finally, after many tries, I finally figured out how to cut and paste it in some text box. And anyway, I opened a ticket with them on that. So that delayed me. But tomorrow I'm going to review the comments, and I do have a few follow-up things to discuss with you, some edge cases, which I have discovered while doing some of the simulations, weird stuff like what if somebody changes something at the wrong time, and there's a variety of different edge cases that we should have a defined behavior for, rather than just hoping for the best. Tomorrow I will review that, and tomorrow also my database team has a telco with Case Western Reserve. Nathaniel, you should be invited to that 1:30 Central Time, 2:30 Eastern, and hopefully we'll get some feedback from them on some of the ideas my team has about the about what to use as far as a framework and database. Finally, since we're getting a little bit closer to having some code that may someday make it into production, I've started adding automated unit tests. Because this program does so much with sockets, conventional unit testing is not exactly, you have to do some special things in the unit testing that normally you wouldn't have to do with, say, like a shared library. But I'm going to code it in so that it starts a thread that you can talk to, and a simulation of the simulator, I guess you would say, so as to test the routines that do that work. So that when you add changes, updates, and things like that, you can tell if you've broken anything in the previously working code. All right, so that's my report. Back to Ned.
Well, fine business, Bill. And next on the list is Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, everyone. A couple of quick comments. I actually spent most of last week fighting a nasty cold and making a decision that I probably will never spend another winter in the Carolinas. So I have to go someplace where it's a little nicer and a little warmer. Anyway, a couple of observations from the work on the PyHPSDR, LinHPSDR, multiple single board computer extravaganza that's been going on. PyHPSDR runs better than LinHPSDR. Even on a Pi 3, and it runs much better on a Pi 4, runs much better than it does on the Odroid. So if I compare the Odroid to the Raspberry Pi 3, the performance is actually better on the Pi 3 with Pi HPSDR. So I guess that kind of proves what I consider to be an axiom of single board computers and Linux OSs, and that is that the best performance comes from the most prolific single board computer and the most used operating system. So anyway, that's kind of in a nutshell, that's kind of what I've taken out of all of this. I really came to kind of dislike the Odroid M2 a lot after using it for a while. There has to be a better alternative than that one. So anyway, that's kind of my rant. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, and thanks for the feedback. That brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion.
Well, don't everybody all talk at once?
So, Tom, yeah, I know I have to review that document. I just haven't got to it yet. I was looking at Bill's schedule there, but I should have some time tomorrow. Would that be good enough?
Yeah, that's fine. It's not the document itself. It's Appendix A. I'm not sure what to put in there. I was scratching my head and figured I'd need people who are more knowledgeable about what's going on than I have.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't even looked at that at all. It's been hasn't been my priority here, but it's should be.
Okay. At any rate, I appreciate it. I went through all the schematics. I went through the layout. Incidentally, GC Preview is no longer free software. It's $60 per year per seat license fee. even for the totally stripped down version.
Oh, really? Okay. Could you find an alternative?
I just looked at them and decided, you know, that as best I could tell, looking at separate images, everything was okay.
Okay, yeah, because I think we can get Dave to send us a layered PDF. It's not quite as good as the Gerber, but it comes pretty close.
Okay, worst comes worse, I've got an XP computer up on the shelf, safely air-gapped from the universe, that I think has the old free version installed.
Yeah, I know my XP machine has a free version on it still, but none of my Windows 10 machines do.
At any rate, I went through all of that, got the ICD updated, and printed out the schematics, and so far everything looks good.
So were you able to extract the exact dimensions of where the connectors go?
No, I did not. I did not try to do that.
So we can get Dave to give us a dimensioned version if we tell him what we want dimensioned.
Yeah, I'll need a dimensioned drawing probably to insert into the ICD. You know, shows where the screw holes are, where the connectors are, the board shape, the outlines, the offsets, all that stuff. I think he may have had some stuff in there. I need to go back and review it. But if there's a good enough drawing in there, I'll yank it out. If not, we'll figure out what we need from Dave.
Yeah, so should we have of course, I haven't looked at your document yet, but would you have a section in there on, like, the maximum sizes of the plug-in boards? Because they can go up to, you know, 48 millimeters wide or 46 wide, whatever, half the width of the board. And then I don't know what the X dimension is. So we should tell people what, probably just have a drawing outline of the board that mates onto the RF module, right?
Yeah, so I think what we need is the outline of the RF module itself, and the dimensions of other RF modules could be different. They could be double wide, or at some time in the future, the data engine could change, and then some new RF board might have different dimensions. So I was thinking perhaps of just, you know, describing what we got in the ICD for the dual channel receiver.
But we wanted to define maximum dimensions of the plug-in filter boards so that the people, if they design them that way, they know they'll fit onto the board. So you can show that outline on the over the top of the RF module.
Okay, that's a good point. Yeah, the receiver will dictate the filter shapes, connector positions, and sizes. So the receiver module becomes the parent of the requirements for the filter. So I'll go ahead and add that to the ICD.
Yeah, because there's the outline of the existing one that we built already, right, which is really small. And then there's the maximum dimensions, which would include the power connector and a wider board. And then I don't know how much overhang we can get on the other end on the input side connector, but we probably can get a little bit there before we run into a relay.
Yeah. I'll, until we either get a 3D CAD or, you know, can figure out something, I'll at least try to indicate, you know, what we have in terms of existing filters, and we can update it if we get more information for future filters.
All right, sounds good.
I want to mention we have a new addition that didn't get in on the roll call. Orville N8WQ has joined us. Orville, do you have any comments?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Well, first off, let me say that I think this is a really cool project. However, at this moment in time, I don't have anything to contribute. And I hope it's okay if I keep on coming to these sessions, because I'm learning a lot. And one of my questions was about the magnetometers you guys have been discussing. What kind of quality are we talking about here? Are we talking like NASA grade, you know, amateur radio grade? Can someone explain that for me?
Well, that's a question for either Dave, KD0EAG, or Holman, KD2MCR.
Well, simply speaking, well, I guess our goal would be to have something like amateur level, although we haven't really. I guess this would be a better question for Dave, who has developed the magnetometer. But our goal is to make sort of like a mid-grade magnetometer that can be used for scientific application, although the actual quality, the quality in terms of resolution, how finely you can actually resolve the magnetic field may not be as comparable as to the science grade magnetometer, but it could be good enough to see some big magnetic disturbances during so-called geomagnetic storm or substorm, when we see a huge deflection in magnetic field. That kind of deflection, I'm pretty sure we can see. The deflection depends on where you're measuring. If you measure in high latitude, for example, like Canada, Alaska, then you can see the deflection much more clearly. So in this mid latitude regions, the deflection may not be that big, but still the magnetometer that we are hoping for should be able to see some kind of deflection. We're not really looking for really fine, small variations. For example, ultra low frequency waves that is considered to be really important phenomena in space physics, that kind of wave activity may not be able to be visible in this type of magnetometer. But as long as we can see some big deflection during remarkable space weather-related event, that should be sufficient. Which is the deflection that I'm talking about here is about, say, tens of nanotesla change or more. Since the company claims that the resolution of the magnetometer that they provided can reach up to, say, a couple of nanotesla resolution, so we should be able to see some kind of deflection or variation of the magnetic field. So that's our goal. But to be able to see that kind of resolution level, the location of the magnetic sensor is very important. That's why we don't want to put it, for example, like, you know, apartment in the middle of Manhattan, but if you have some quiet area around your house or some kind of remote area like a barn or something like that, then we should be able to see something. So that's what we're hoping for. Then I think the technical details should be deferred to Dave, I guess.
Well, as from my perspective, I don't know that magnetometers in general fall into easy categories like scientific grade or amateur grade. It really depends on what you want to use them for and how much you want to spend. These are quite inexpensive, much more comparable to the MEMS type magnetometers that are used in drones and for general compass purposes, but they're a lot better than those, but they're in the same price range. On the other hand, magnetometers fall into price ranges from about $10 to about $5 million, as far as I can tell, and it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. In some ways, this project and some of the ones contemplated here are more interested in the number that can be deployed than the exact precision of the individual unit. And by having large numbers of them, there are some phenomena that may be more addressable just because of the area covered and the number of sensors involved. So it's kind of hard to say, but they're a lot better than the ones on your typical drone that tell it how to get home. On the other hand, they don't require liquid helium or heavy support structures, and don't cost tens of thousands of dollars on up, which many of the more elegant, the next step up tends to do. The proton precession units, the ones used in a lot of fields like surveying for ore deposits and stuff. I recently found a paper that compares surveying an ore deposit using these units, or a predecessor to these units, with a proton precession magnetometer, and the conclusion seemed to be that these worked at least as well and cost vastly less. So it's how you want to look at it. That's it.
If you allow me to add, Dave actually made a good point that it has been that historically, for example, like NASA spacecraft mission, they try to send really, really high-end, expensive spacecraft in one place to measure really, really high-end measurement. Now the trend has been that, I mean, this is amateur level, so we cannot really beat the performance level that NASA can achieve. But the new trend here is that, okay, let's not worry too much about making single point measurement that precise. Instead, let's just spread a bunch of, you know, economical sensor system in many different places, so we can actually collect data in one place to analyze data to see how things change in more extensive spatial scale, rather than just making one point measurement in one place. So that has been a new direction. And then this is what Nathaniel is really trying to do, using like distributed array system. So yeah, that's of course, it depends on how you want to do it, what you want to do it. But at this moment, we try not to worry too much about the actual performance of the individual system. Rather, we just try to distribute inexpensive system in many places as possible.
Thanks, guys. That's a great explanation. I really appreciate it. And I have another question. What other instruments besides magnetometers are you guys going to be using?
Maybe Nathaniel?
Sure. So the main instruments we're going to have on the system will be the magnetometer. And then we're also going to have a software-defined radio that that's what the Tangerine SDR is working on. And that's going to cover between, from a few hundred kilohertz up to about 60 megahertz. And we're going to focus mostly on the HF band for now, probably from about, 1.8 megahertz up to about 30 megahertz. And one of the things about this Tangerine SDR and that core instrument is that software-defined radio will actually be able to serve as multiple instruments simultaneously, because we can have it do some analysis, like if we wanted to listen for doing CW type skimming, it could do that. If we went to do PSK, like monitor FT8 and other amateur signals, it can do that and report those back to those networks. But at the same time, we can also have it make measurements of noise. We can have it listen for ionosondes or for, say, super darn radars. So it can run in a number of different modes. Also attached to the whole system will be a GPS disciplined oscillator, which will provide stability to the system. So those are the Tangerine, the software-defined radio, and the magnetometer are the two core instruments we have right now. And then it's supposed to be a modular system, so that if people want to add additional instruments later, we can do that.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Orville, you may, depends on your particular situation, you may want to look at the tangerinesdr.com webpage. There's a number of documents. There's requirements documents for the various instruments. There's some system specifications. And no one documents any more than about 10 pages.
Okay, thanks, Tom. I've already been reading the documentation and looking at the various websites, but I'm just trying to get a generalized umbrella view of the project.
If you hold on a second, I'll have a PDF link I can send out that has a good overview.
One thing that we tried to do, Orville, is add standard interfaces. So the PMOD is the one we hook the magnetometer to, but there are many, 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 many different kinds of sensors that interface to PMOD ports. And we also have a Raspberry Pi-like hat has low-speed I.O. that has I2C interfaces and SPI interfaces that multiple sensors can interface to. So we're really kind of leaving it open to be able to add any kind of sensors that we want to in the future once we actually figure out what we want to measure.
Okay, that sounds great, guys.
And Orville, I just posted a link to the a PDF of the talk I gave down at Hamcation, which gives an overview of the project.
Sounds good. I'll definitely check those two links out.
I'd like to have a question for Dave. How long can this sensor go from the main electronics?
I'm not sure I understood the tail end of that. How long can this go from the main, what was that?
The distance between the sensor and the main electronics. So our goal is to put the sensor outside, away from any electromagnetic noise, and then put the electronics inside the house.
Well, at this point, the extender function of the magnetometer support board is working as we had wanted it to on a length of 100 foot length of Cat 6A type shielded cable, which effectively moves it 100 feet from from the other electronics. Is that what you mean?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, 100 feet seems to be pretty good. Thank you.
I just put a link to a paper where they were doing something quite similar for other reasons, but they were trying to separate their electronics from the sensor, and they seem to have it about 4 or 5 inches, which is pretty minor compared to this. But they were using the older boards that only had an SPI interface.
So you're basically saying 100 feet is possible, right? The computer and acquisition electronics inside the building, whatever building you have, and then 100 feet out from the building, right?
That would probably be how someone would do it. You could put the other electronics out in a build, in some other kind of sheltered arrangement as well, but and connect it back with Ethernet. But 100 feet between the single board computer is how I'm testing it. It'd be 100 feet from the data engine, I guess, in the way that Scotty has conceived of it. So wherever the radio, the other support electronics can be separated by essentially 30 meters. It seems to work well.
Great, thank you.
I don't know if you saw the, I posted on Google Drive, I guess, and sent you a link, I hope, some data I collected over a 24-hour period about a week ago through that 100-foot link. Just looking for continuity, not really looking to test the magnetometer functionality, not in any rigorous way. But I had put some extraneous text into the file. I'm now collecting a new file that'll be easier to run some statistics on. And I'll post that when I get it all together.
Yes, thank you. I did receive the email that has link, but I haven't really looked at it, but I will do so as soon as possible. Thank you.
let me know if you have any problem, but I wanted to be sure it got through.
Okay, great. Thank you. Since nobody's talking right now, one thing that we could do later, not right now, after we verify that the magnetometer itself is fully functional electronically, then what we could do is to bring one of the system into our lab where we can have zero field around it, so we can verify that it's not really creating any noise inside. We can make sure that zero is supposed to be really zero rather than some bias value. So we have a little bit of inexpensive shielding case where we can put the sensor inside to simulate a zero environment, just to be sure that zero output is really zero. So that's something we could do pretty simply.
That sounds great. I'm working on getting a pair of these boards ready to send to you or give to you. If I don't get them any sooner, I certainly plan to have them by the time of the meeting. But if I get them sooner, I will just post them to you and for your testing.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Scotty, do we yet have a schedule in terms of board production and building first prototypes for any of the units beyond the magnetometer?
No, not quite yet, because I'm still struggling along with the data engine. It seems to be things getting in the way, but I just had some good news today. Well, I guess good news for the data engine. I'm going to have some freed up time here in the next week or two, so I'm going to try real hard to get at least a bare board of the data engine by Hamvention. So that'll put us pretty much early in the summer for a complete set. Well, a set of boards anyway, not the clock module necessarily, but we can start testing with just the two boards.
Okay, very good. Well, that's certainly good news. I know the data engine is a pretty complicated beast.
Yeah, and the problem is we really need to have a pinout of the clock module. That's kind of the last thing and as evidenced by what we had to do with the RF module, I wouldn't have liked to have the data engine already done before the clock module was proposed. So they all got to kind of morph together, and there may yet be clock or RF module changes induced by what happens on the data engine. I'm hoping not, but we may have to kind of morph the size a little bit, maybe make it a little bit bigger if we have to make the data engine bigger.
Okay, very good. Very good. Understand. There's a lot of moving pieces.
Yeah, so I figured that if we can at least get the placement of the data engine down, and we can get it so that Dave is happy with he thinks he'll be able to route it, then we can go ahead and start building the RF module. We're already really prepped and ready to pull the trigger on it. We've got the parts list all ready to go. In fact, I can send you a copy of that if you want, but it's just taking the BOM and costing it all out and getting ready to buy prototype quantities of the parts, but not just quite yet.
No problem.
Sorry, my handheld crashed about the time you tried to answer the question I posed to you. Could you give me a thumbnail sketch of it again, please?
Okay, I didn't hear your question, so maybe it was crashed a little earlier than you thought. Please repeat it again.
Oh, okay. Well, you said you're shooting to have a data engine soon, some prototypes. As far as the FPGA code for that, had you planned on like a simple hello world as a first version zero in that for testing, or did you want to try and do more with that for a version zero?
For version zero, I'm just going to do a loopback, just a manufacturing test basically to make sure everything is talking to each other, and then I want to implement some. Well, of course, the first thing I want to implement is programmability so that we can upload the firmware at will. Because once we get the bootloader in and programmability without having to load the whole Cortis suite, that makes it so much easier for anyone who has one to be able to just upgrade it.
Yeah, and as I recall, Dave was working on a program that was going to be the eventual bootloader.
Yep, you want to answer that, Dave?
Well, I am. I built one for the Open HPSDR group, and I haven't started working on that because I'm working with Scotty to get some of the details of the architecture of the FPGA.
Yeah, so once we're off laying out the board and ordering parts and all that that I don't have to be directly involved in, and Dave and I can get together and maybe we can actually do some testing on the IQ2, which is hardware that he and I both have, and we can do some software testing on that, and then just port the IQ2 code right over to the data engine pretty much right after the manufacturing test runs, and then we'll be able to program it. And even if we could just, you know, program it once and then change the code and program it with a different frequency blinky light, at least we can prove we can upgrade the firmware without having to have, you know, 3 gig of downloads of software to do it.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, but Dave's got a lot of that part already done, so it's just if I can build the matching part in the FPGA to talk to his software, and it's going to be mostly the same, right, Dave? Are you going to have to do a lot of massaging to make it talk differently? Because I think we're planning for the protocol to be very similar to protocol 1 for the programming.
Well, it really doesn't make that much difference between the two protocols. The main thing is the configuration of the flash and how we address it and get to it.
So did that answer your question, Bill?
Well, I sort of just trying to think of what I can do to help to support you guys. Maybe some simple piece of code from the local host that shakes hands with the first generation code, as so we can get some experience testing it in that way.
Well, we're going to want to be able to update the data engine from the local host, right?
That is the plan. Now, there's a couple of different possibilities there. One is using a separate program like Dave would write, or the other is integrating it in with the, well, I don't know that I would necessarily integrate it in. I would probably implement it as a call, as a process I would spool off or thread off from the main program through a system call. That way would have the program, the loader program would be independent, but something like that.
Well, Mike, go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to say, as long as you connect to it through a system call, that should be no problem at all.
And my vision was to have, a web page update. So, you know, the web page to control it, and kind of like, you know, the web page you had there at Hamcation, but there would be a page for programming, and you'd be able to go in and go to a website and pick images and download them off of the internet and then port them over, you know, send them over to the DE.
Yeah,
that may be a little bit later down the road. Sorry, double with you. That might be a little bit later down the road, too aggressive for version 1.
Oh, I don't think so. The main thing is just as long as we have a program that runs in Linux that we can do a system call to trigger it and pass it something like the path name of the path of the file that contains the code you want to load into the device. That's pretty straightforward.
So then that would just be the API definition, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We add it to that. Sure, yeah.
So I mean, then what you could do is you could have a program as part of your web browser that would just call Dave's program with his defined API to say, program the DE with this file. Here you go.
Yeah, that's quite feasible. Yes.
So then all the security for not upgrading the program in the middle of doing something important is going to rest on the local host, right?
Yes, I would think so, yes. I mean, the user owns the Odroid or whatever the device is going to be, and you can hardly stop them from opening up a separate terminal and doing whatever they want with it. But, you know, I guess you have to at some point figure that the user is not going to want to destroy his own device. If it can be set up so that the update of the firmware is something that can only happen through a local connection, I'm not sure how you can guarantee that.
Well, yeah, I don't know how you do that either technically, but you can make it so it's a manual operation only that has to be initiated on the local host itself. Or you could maybe perhaps make it something that would be enableable by the host. So what I'm thinking is we may have a whole bunch of network of these units that the user says, hey, yeah, if you got an upgrade, send it to me. I'll take it. And other guys will say, don't you dare touch my data engine. I don't want you upgrading anything. So we ought to have the option to set it either way the user wants.
And would you think that would be a firmware switch or a physical switch?
Firmware switch, I would think, would be okay. Or if a jumper, if you want. I mean, I don't know what level of security you want, because if you make it a jumper, and it's pretty physically robust as far as getting it to run the way you want. If you put a firmware switch on, I guess if you hack into the board, then you can. But then think of it this way: if you hack into the board, you can probably take the dependency on the jumper out also. So I think a firmware switch is good.
Yeah, what would your buddy from Motorola have to say about it?
He'd probably tell me I'm insane.
Right. Would he have a recommendation, though, on what to do?
Well, if you're behind a firewall and you have security, then it doesn't really matter, because if you can hack into the board, then you can hack into the board. So if we can prevent that, then... But I can certainly ask him.
I'd just be interested to see what his opinion would be about it. I mean, you can make things all about security and make it so secure that the average user can't use it. I mean, it's something you got to guard against too.
Yeah, really. I mean, the most secure thing would be to put the jumper on the data engine and just jumper the write protect, and so that there would be no physical way that you could even do it.
One concern might be how you remotely update units. If there's a number of these units deployed in the field, you might want to update them without having to physically drive to each and every site.
That is true.
But then if we can make it so that the user can set it up as updatable or fixed, then it would be, in the cases where you don't want your unit to be updated, you could still connect to the network and not be subject to being updated against your will, so to speak.
Yeah, so that, that's where I think, Scotty, your idea of a firmware switch is probably a good one, in that you rely on someone to correctly configure the data engine to be updatable or not updatable. And then if it's configured to be updatable, you set the firmware switch that way.
Yeah, especially for units that are in remote locations, you're right. You don't want to have to drive there and flip a switch to update it.
Yeah, I've heard the driving on the road to Antarctica is a real tough one.
Yeah, I was going to say that Nathaniel might have to go down somewhere with a snowcat to be able to do the work.
Yeah, you never know. Or you send a tech out there. As long as it's over at like McMurdo Station or South Pole Station, you have someone who can go out there and adjust it. But if it's somewhere more remote in the field. But at that point, I mean, down in Antarctica, just trying to push that amount of data down there, that's a challenge in itself.
So all that water between Tierra del Fuego and McMurdo gets to the carburetor.
Absolutely.
How big are these firmware packages that pushing a firmware update to a remote location that remote would be really a problem? I don't have any feel for how many kilobytes or megabytes we're talking about here.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to guess a couple of megabits maybe for a full load.
User disconnected from your channel. Couple of megabits?
Megabits. It's serial ROM, so I mean, what, 128K bytes?
That's not too bad, 128 kilobytes.
Yeah, let me, while you guys continue on here a second, let me look up the size of the programming file for this part.
Bill, if you're curious, I put a link to the GitHub site where the existing code already exists.
You're talking about the bootloader code or the firmware itself?
It's the bootloader code used with the OpenHPSDR project.
Oh, okay. And to use it, what do you do? Just type in the name of the program followed by the path to the where the new code is?
Yes or no. If you use the command line one, the code's all written in Go or Golang, and There is a command line one that will talk to your FPGA. It'll talk to an open HPSDR radio. And then there is a web-based one where it uses basically a web interface to the Go code.
I don't know. Well, I don't understand all the details well enough to make any firm recommendation. But my first impulse would be to use a command line because that's so easy for me to trigger from inside of the main controller.
But you do have to have access to, at least in the way we've done it before, on the radio board, there's some switches that have to be thrown, unless Scotty's got a clever way to get around that.
Sorry, I was reading something else. What was the question?
Well, on OpenHPSDR, we have a programming mode and a running mode. And there's a hard switch or a jumper on the board of OpenHPSDR. Are you going to try to eliminate the need for that switch?
Yes, we won't need a jumper. We will not need a jumper.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a firmware switch. I think that's what we were just referring to a few minutes ago.
Well, the firmware switch would enable programming, but the way the Max 10 works is it actually internally has space for two images. So we put the bootloader image in one side and the real image in the other, and then we can transfer control to the boot image. The real image can transfer control to the boot image, and in reality, the real image has, both images have bootloaders in them. So what happened is you normally boot side A, and it always works, and you accept commands to reprogram the flash itself, because they get a little bit confusing here. The FPGA runs out of RAM, okay? So when you boot, it copies the flash, half of the flash, into the RAM configuration. So while you're running out of RAM configuration, you can actually reprogram the flash while you're running out of RAM configuration. And then when you reboot, you get the new configuration that gets reloaded again out of the updated flash into the RAM. Now, if you happen to mess up and unplug your board in the middle of a configuration or load an image that is broken, then the Max 10 has a feature that they will try to load side A, and if it can't, if it gets a bad checksum or a bad program, then it automatically reverts to side B, which is the known good bootloader that we never touch. So that gives you your guaranteed it always works image, so we don't need a jumper.
Yep, that makes sense.
Did I do that too fast for anyone?
No, I think we got it.
I'm looking for sizes of the files, and all the stupid document gives me is how many milliseconds does it take to boot, to copy? So, and since I don't know the exact frequency that it runs at, I can't tell how many bytes it is. So I'm still looking. Interestingly enough, the Max 10 has a unique ID serial number built into each chip.
That's helpful.
Yeah, you can actually enforce license requirements by putting an encrypted copy of the license key of the serial number, and in order for it to run, it has to decrypt that and compare it to see if whether it's authorized to run that machine. But I don't think we want to do that.
Yeah, the crypto part does have ability to store keys, so you could have, in fact, multiple keys. So you could have a specific upgrade key, I guess, if you wanted, that you could store into everyone before it left the factory.
I think you should tell your Motorola buddy about that chip, because it would warm the cockles of his heart to know that he could do that, that he could recommend some things to use that for.
What, the unique ID?
The encrypted key chip.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not an encryption engine. It's just the ID tags, so we have to do the encryption ourselves. Well, but, you know, what other ways do we have to have fun, right?
Yeah, why not add some unnecessary stuff to the project? That's always fun.
Yeah, really? Even more than we have already, you mean?
Yeah, it takes me back to the old days of working for DOD. Just put all kinds of unnecessary stuff in there just because you can.
Well, it's free, right? Because we all work for nothing.
That's one way of looking at it.
Well, this is interesting. I'm almost through the whole document, and I haven't found the size of the flash yet.
Well, Scotty, I looked up on the OpenHPSDR. The RBF files are 634 KB.
That's KBytes?
Correct.
And which board is that for?
Hermes.
So that's for a 3C 40, I think.
Yes, that's correct.
So that would be comparable, except we're 50k logic elements, and that's 40k, and there's Cyclone 5 elements. And we also can do RBF compression, which gets you nearly 2-to-1. So I would say you might get 630k bytes, so you might get 500k bytes.
Now, when we do this, I want to make sure that we put some checksums in this whole process, which was one of the problems we had otherwise.
Yeah. So we build a checksum into each packet, right?
Yep. And test it.
And you are allowed to ask for a resend on a packet, right? Or no?
Yes. If we're strictly following the old protocols, the one no, but the two yes. But, you know, there is this question, do we stick to what those two protocols are, or is there a slightly different variation of the two protocol?
Well, does the HPSDR protocol allow you to do a retry?
In protocol one, it will not work, so you have to redo it from the beginning. And in protocol two, you can replace pieces.
So you can NAC a packet or get a bad checksum without either NAC or ignore it. And then what, then the host sends the packet over again? That what, 256 bytes over?
Yes, I believe that's correct. The protocol one, the whole thing just doesn't work, and you have to redo it. And if, depending on how far it got in the process, the programmer can sometimes redo it, and sometimes you've messed it up enough, you got to go back to the regular programmer. Remember, we were learning when we did this?
Yeah, I do remember that. Okay, let's see. Total configuration memory size in K bits. This can't be right. It's got to be K bytes. It says, it's 10,752 K bits. So that's 10.7 megabits. So what is that? About 1.2 megabytes?
I think so.
So it'd be 10,752 K or 10.752 megabits.
So Nathaniel, does that sound like a lot to have to send to Antarctica?
I would say, you know, again, depends on where it is. If it's a McMurdo station, a couple of megabytes is very reasonable. If it were out in the deep field, it would, you know, a few kilobytes is much better. But that's a very extreme situation. But I also suppose it's a possible one. So the ones at the AGO stations, they are connected via Iridium sat phones, and those are very slow.
Are they expensive for data too?
Yes. But I don't know how that data bill is taken care of. I don't think the data cost is a problem. But you said in terms of like bytes, how big did you say this was?
Well, the total configuration memory is 1.2 megabytes, but that's two images. In fact, it looks like it might even be more than two images. So I still say that we're on the order of 500k bytes for an image, for a reprogramming image.
I think that sounds very reasonable.
You sure bury it in here deep, I can tell you that. Because the Max 10 itself does compression of RBF or the bitstream. So, and from what I remember, it may be better these days. It used to be approximately 2-to-1. And so we could get a good reduction in size of the programming file by turning compression on. And I love it. It says that a sector is the smallest unit of the PROM that you can erase. And it doesn't tell you how big a sector is.
Oh, yeah. They're making that tricky, aren't they?
I guess you have to really want to know. Sorry, say again, Bill.
Nothing.
You got to really want to know. Okay, here's the, so it says a page is the smallest amount of flash memory that you can erase at one time. Our pages are 64K bits, 64K bits in a page. So that would be 8K bytes. That's how much we have to erase at a time. So we have to make sure we can resend that sector, that page. If we're going to erase the whole page, we have to make sure that we can replace it, or if it gets munged, we can get a repeat on the whole page. But this is interesting. Then the next sentence says you can erase each page or sector independently. So I don't have any idea what they're talking about.
Now, this is just for the FPGA image, right?
Yes, this is inside the Max 10 part.
Okay. So, I mean, presumably, you know, you'd be talking to, like, this single board computer, and then that would send the information over to the FPGA, right?
Yes, and the FPGA has a big DRAM on it, so we got lots of buffering room if we want to, like, load up a bunch of 256-byte packets to make an 8K-byte page and then program that to the flash all at once.
That sounds reasonable.
Is that something that we could do, Dave?
Yes, I think we can do that. I just need to be able to understand the organization of the packets, and that'll take a little time to sit down and fully comprehend.
Especially with such great documentation as we have here. Well, I guess that's all I'm going to be able to find from this fine business document here. But it is interesting that there's two images, and it automatically switches between the two when you try to load a bad image in.
Well, that's good. That's much simpler than what we had before. We actually had one memory, and we divided it ourselves, and you just changed the base address space.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, this may be a question more for Phil, but because there's a user flash IP that you put in the FPGA that talks directly to the flash memory that allows you to program it, but it's not clear how you address it. So the two images in the flash, in like in say Hermes, are they at opposite ends, or are they one right after the other, or are they one in the lower half, one in the upper half? Do you remember how that works?
It's more the last letter. One starts at zero and one starts at 1,000,000.
So how do you get the flash to load from 1,000,000? That must be in the IP then.
When you put things in, so yeah, it's in the code, but essentially you put in the bootloader, and that you do that with your regular commercial programmer, and then this code was in the old Cyclone would talk to that bootloader, and it would put it into the flash memory.
Okay, so but the question is, when you put the jumper on, somebody has to go read the jumper and decide which half of the flash to load for its when it's in load mode, and that's all done in hardware in the Cyclone 3.
Yes, and that's what the switch was for, was to tell you which one it was doing.
Right, so what I'm guessing is that that IP core that you instantiate in the code, in the FPGA code, actually had the hooks in it to set the flash memory to either 0 or 1,000,000 to start its load.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense then. Okay, so, and the thing about the user flash memory is it's the same deal. It's you have an IP block that you instantiate in the FPGA code that talks to the internal memory in the Max 10 and allows you to boot either half or erase half and leave one half intact. So we would just leave the one half of it always having the bootloader in it, always intact, never erase it. And then the other half would be where we put our actual operational code. And then if it got munged somehow, it would default back to the bootloader, and then you just reload the other half again.
Yeah, I think that'd be the way to do it.
Yeah, Dave, on OpenHPSDR, does the FPGA have the capability to go to the alternate image automatically, or does that have to be done by the user changing a jumper if the image gets messed up?
It goes by changing the jumper, because they're actually only one memory space, and it's just divided by the HPSDR team, not by Altair or any of that. So that's where things get messed up, particularly if somebody uses a USB blaster and don't understand this architecture, they can write the radio code in the wrong segment, and it will go in and it will actually run, but you'll never be able to replace it with any of the software we built to replace it.
Okay, so the advantage of what Scotty has here is that it's automatic. If you hose up that first image, the hardware is automatically recovers without any user intervention.
Yes, and the having the two separate memory spaces is really a very nice thing, and the automatic swapping.
Yeah, and that's built into the Cyclone or to the Max 10, because normally when you pull the reconfiguration pin on the FPGA, there's no memory in it at all. I mean, there's memory for the configuration, but there's no state information preserved when you pull the reconfigure pin. So in other words, you can't tell whether this is a warm reprogram or a cold reprogram.
You know, in all the ones I worked on, people would always think they'd ruined the chip, but I think there was less than one, or I think one or two at the most, that I couldn't ever eventually fix.
And these were Hermes boards?
Hermes and or Metis.
Oh, okay. So even the Atlas systems, you could. Yeah, that's right, because you could use your programmer. And then you had to put the board, one board in at a time next to Metis, and you could program each of them also, right?
Yeah, they use the Metis as a JTAG programmer to program the other boards. And that's what those kinds of convoluted things tended to confuse people who don't do it all the time.
Yeah, they confused me, I know that. I had a heck of a time getting it working. But I think you have documentation. If you take the time to read, you can figure it out.
Yes, there is documentation on all of it. Sometimes it helps to also be able to read code.
You're self-documenting code?
Well, if you understand what you're trying to do, then it's easier to figure out, well, how did they do it? So anyway, I should mention we're a little over.
Yep, we are. So very good, everyone. Anything else anyone wants to bring up?